Thanks for ringing the bell. And hello again. Just hoping it's a good sit. It's really nice to sit with everyone. So lots happened since we last met. I was thinking about this. The passing of Desmond Tutu. Oh, so sad. The fires and the Omicron and all that's happening with the fear and uncertainty of whatever stage of COVID land we're in right now, double mask and don't go outside and not being able to test, and just sort of how all that is playing out in our nervous systems about, oh my God, moving into year three, just naming, there's a lot to hold. And I wanted to explore today, and I'll be honest, I'm going to talk about a book that I actually haven't read, which I always feel a little dodgy doing, but read some articles, listened to some podcasts, and I'm going to order the book. So I think this might be part one of two talks, because my little greedy mind, the last 24 hours is like, oh, all these different things we could talk about. So bear with me. But the podcast that a friend of mine told me about, it's by a guy from the New York Times, Ezra Klein, and he interviewed a woman, Annie Murphy Paul, who has written a book, I think it came out in June, called The Extended Mind. And this is the book I have not read, but I'm going to talk about it anyway. But what I love about the pointings and the interviews and the articles that I read is this and the ever-present inquiry for me as a practitioner and as a therapist and just as a human of how do we work with this mind of ours? And my daughter has done some of the family meditation classes, and I had signed her up for the teen class this winter, and for good reasons there's conflicts that she can't do it. And I had said, look, you know, the best thing that you can learn in your life perhaps at this stage is really like, how do we work with the mind ongoingly? That I feel like our minds can get us into so much trouble. It can also take us to amazing places, but the ways in which we think, or the thoughts can loop, or the stories we tell ourselves can be so crippling or hindering, or at least that's the ways in which we can get in our way. Needless to say, she rolled her eyes at me, but it's to be expected. But just this way of how do we work with this mind of ours in a time, culturally, evolutionarily, whatever, where we are so and this is a phrase from this article, brain bound, as if all things can be figured out through the brain and the thinking mind. And going back to the days of Descartes, of I think, therefore I am, the split between placing such a hierarchy on the thinking mind, the rational mind, as distinct and separate and severed from the body and the knowing. And we could look at this from this severing of masculine and feminine, not gender, but energies, and the intuitive nature of the feminine energy, again, embodied by men and women and more gender fluid folk. How do we intentionally reclaim the wisdom that's in the body? Because the thinking mind can't do it all. And in a New York Times article, I'll read a little bit from this woman that came out, the article came out in June. One of the things, so I just feel a little bit disjointed, so bear with me, but one of the things she posits is she talks about the different metaphors that we have relied upon about the brain. Like the brain is like a computer, or the growth mindset, like it's a muscle. We flex the muscle a lot and then we'll get smarter. And she's kind of like, if that were true, we'd be really smart. Like we would be like wise by now. And I think we can all agree we're not really living in the most wise times. And she offers a couple different analogies of how she's a science writer and has done a lot of research. The term extended mind comes from an article or book by Andy Clark that came out a while ago, which is a different tangent I'm not going to go on, but just this phrase of extended mind. How she's taken it and the research that she's done is looking at it, not so much of Andy Clark and his colleague, we're looking more at how this phone is like become an extension of our brain because we offload phone numbers. For those of us old enough to remember life before phones, we knew people's phone numbers. We can just dial them. And now it's like, oh, I don't know, because we've offloaded that. Any Harry Potter fans, we can remember, I don't know which book it first came out in, but the pensieve of Dumbledore, who's headmaster of Hogwarts, and he has this amazing bowl in which he can put the wand to his mind, to the bowl, and then all these thoughts, all the thoughts he doesn't want to carry around go into this bowl. Remember when I first read that, I'm like, oh, it's genius. If only we had this capacity to offload thoughts or memories or whatever that we carry around in this brain of ours, to be able to offload it. And in the course of her research, so we do that in certain ways. And how can we more skillfully look into how does this brain of ours actually work? And she points to the brain evolved back at a time for thousands of years when we were outside all the time and interacting with nature all the time. And now we're inside, a lot of us, all the time. and this constant stimulation from computers and phones and information, and that the brain, as it has evolved over millennia, is absolutely ill-equipped to deal with this life right now. And I think I'll speak for myself, this ways in which certainly during COVID time, when we've been in these kind of silos of our own homes, or we can't see people, and then we were able to see people, and now they're saying, no, don't see people, that in our silos, there's so much more interaction on screens. We're sitting more. We're not even, there's no commute. We're not walking down, for many of us, not walking down the hallways of our offices or hanging out at the proverbial water cooler with folks. We're not moving our bodies as much. Not only if we go back to where the conditions under which the brain was evolving, that body of ours that was outside was moving, right? Our bodies now don't really move. It's like, oh yeah, it's a good idea to get exercise. And a friend of mine had said, you know, that I think it's in the book, it's not so much that exercise is an antidote to depression, which it is, we can argue, but that the lack of exercise is conducive to depression, because this organism of ours that is not two separate, it's not the mind and the body, but this the entirety conglomeration wants to move and engage with an environment. And one of the metaphors that I mentioned, she speaks about with the brain. I actually took a picture of it on my phone. This might be faster. I compare the brain to a magpie. One of these birds that plucks a twig here and a piece of string here, and also the more unusual things. I mean, the catalog of things that a magpie have incorporated into their nests is amazing. But the point is that they build their nest from whatever is available in their immediate environment. And the brain is something like that. It's assembling its thought processes from what's available in its environment. And that means that thinking better is not about working the brain ever harder. It's about creating a space and a set of capacities wherein you have more and better resources from which you can assemble your thought processes. And I love this idea. It's like, what? But this notion of whatever we use, what's at hand, and how can we create and set about intentionally to create environments that support conditions in which the brain will thrive. And she talks about supply and demand of attention. And we can typically, and I know this for myself, sort of demand attention, like pay attention to this article or something I'm writing or something I'm reading. And this demand, if I just like white knuckle myself to pay attention, and that usually doesn't work. And her invitation is like, no, let's focus on the supply side of my attention, trying to expand the amount of attention we have, trying to replenish the attention we have. So how does using this framework change what we do? And she talks about we were outside 90% of the time, and now we're inside buildings, we're inside cars. And even when we're in an urban, it's highly built up urban setting. The thing that about the outdoors and the way that human species have evolved is that all the information we encounter, the sensory information that we encounter in nature, is processed really easily and effortlessly and efficiently by the brain. Our sensory faculties are kind of tuned in to the kind of information and stimuli that we encounter in nature. And so this is, again, the scientific reason behind what everybody knows, which we feel more relaxed when we're out in nature. We're more at ease when we take a walk outside or we spend time with the trees or by a body of water. But what do we do with the attention? This is kind of a diffuse attention. And we talk about this in meditation, a kind of open-ended attention where the mind can just kind of rest. Open-ended awareness. Can we create that clearing? And that line I quote all the time, can we create a clearing in the dense busyness of our minds to see what arises? Or from Ajahn Chah, that sense of a still forest pond. May our minds be like that still forest pond. Whatever comes to drink from the pond is reflected, but the nature of the mind is the stillness. But in our reality now, where there's so much bombardment, there's not a lot of stillness in the mind. So how can we set up conditions such that we can cultivate that stillness? And her pointing to when we are out in nature, the body's like, oh, it knows how to communicate and move in the world. We're getting less skilled at it, particularly like kids that used to kind of, I mean, I remember I used to run pretty free as a kid, and that's not happening so much anymore. We're getting less comfortable in the natural world and at our own peril. In this diffuse attention, we are able to spend time in nature, allowing the gentle movements and the soft contours of things that we see outside entertain our attention in a diffuse way. It's sort of a soft fascination. It's not hard-edged concentration, like, oh, I have to focus on this thing. The soft fascination you might experience when you're looking at leaves in the wind or watching waves on the ocean, that state restores our attention. It kind of refills the tank. And so then we can return to our desk or whatever we're doing and be able to complete our whatever work we have at hand because we have been able to replenish this sense of attention. And I love this idea. I hadn't thought about it before, but that there's the looking at it from demand of our attention versus how do we store it, restore it? How do we fill that reservoir back up? In the New York Times article, excuse my shuffling of papers. It's a long one. Where is it? She writes, the skills we develop and the techniques we are taught are mostly that involve our individual unaided brains, committing information to memory, engaging with internal reasoning and deliberation. We become increasingly more siloed in how we think. And I think life under COVID has accentuated that because we're not really engaging with others as much. We're sort of engaging with a screen or information data stimulus, but we don't have the human engagement. And we see, I think this is part, perhaps, of what we're seeing nationally here in the States, I think globally also, but with this incredible polarization of ideas. If I'm only looking at websites or news feeds that are already in agreement with what I believe, then I can feel really self-righteous and right in my thinking, but I'm completely shut off or cut off from other viewpoints. And this real, I don't know, tragedy, potential fall of our democracy is kind of at risk here. And today is the 6th. It was a year ago today that there was the insurgency in DC. And Jimmy Carter has an article in the New York Times today saying, hello, folks, that was really critical what happened a year ago, and we're not really paying attention to it. And through, these are my words, not his, the siloing of our lives that's become more intense under COVID, and the play at which we can be manipulated by social media is increasing this polarization at our peril. There's a study in Jimmy Carter's article about, I think 40% of Americans believe American life is deteriorating, and that, and 40% of Republicans, I think he quotes, believe that violence against government is appropriate and sometimes, and that we're sort of tilting towards what can become more violence because of, I believe, the siloing that's happening where we're not in conversation. To loop it back, and forgive me, I'm a little all over the place, but if we loop it back to what Annie Murphy Paul talks about, that we need to be, our bodies are wired not only to be in nature, but to be with others. You know, the mirror neurons that happen when we're together, we sync up. We can, our nervous systems, we can lend our nervous system to another, but we need to be human. We need to be present with a human in order for that to happen to some degree. I think it can certainly happen online. But the, again, the state of perilousness, it feels like with this siloing that's happening, if I'm left to my own thoughts and only reading things that support those thoughts, there's a danger there. There's also the ways in which it's coming, bring it back to the meditation, that our minds, we can start believing all of our thoughts. And even the siloing just of our own thoughts, this part of the real estate, as distinct from the rest of our body, which has profound wisdom, if only we allow ourselves and train ourselves to pay attention to the wisdom in the body. And this is why I think it's going to be a part two, because I do want to talk about Bessel van der Kolk's book on the body keeps score, and in the, and I've trained in the somatic experiencing as how do we really listen to what is stored in the body and the wisdom in the body. As women, there's such a deep intuition. I don't mean to say that as women we have a corner on the market, but there is this intuition that needs to be kind of woken up and cultivated as a valuable source of information. We all know that gut sense, or someone's like, it's that sense of like, maybe don't do that, or don't take this turn, or don't go out, or stay home. And the presence of mind, and I'm using that phrase intentionally, to be able to drop into the body enough to be like, wait, what was that sense? And in the book, in this author speaks about the interoception, which is just being able to understand what are the sensations of the body. We do this all the time in meditation. What's happening in the body? Can we feel what's happening in the body? Can we be connected to the wisdom that is inherent in this body of ours? That's so attuned to being the animal body, right? You know, Mary Oliver's like, can we let this animal body of ours love what it loves? And for many of us, it loves being outside in nature. And how much time do we actually get to have that experience? Going back to the Times article, compared to the okay, oh, she's also talks about, sorry to be a little disjointed here, committing information to memory, engaging in internal resourcing and deliberation, mustering our mental powers from within. Compared to the attention we lavish on the brain, we expend relatively very little effort on cultivating our ability to think outside the brain. The limits of this approach have become painfully evident. The days when we could do it all in our heads are over. Our knowledge is too abundant, our expertise too specialized, our challenges too enormous. The best chance we have to thrive in the extraordinarily complex world that we've created is to allow the world to assume some of that mental labor. Our brains cannot do it alone. And part of the ways that she's saying that we can look outside ourselves, extending our brain, is in relationship to others. And she speaks about the looping that the brain is kind of meant for. And looping meaning, I'm working on something, I'm stuck. I go talk to my colleague or my friend to talk it through. And then maybe I go play basketball or go for a bike ride. And then I come back and pick it back up again. And then maybe I talk to somebody else and loop it through. And from an efficiency point of view, it's like totally inefficient. And yet, that's how the brain wants to move. It wants to loop in other feedback from other humans. It wants to loop in the experience in nature. It wants the body to move. And it's funny, and those of you who know me know I talk with my hands a lot, which might be really irritating on screen, but it talks about the gesturing as a as can help in the fluidity of speech and sort of studies they've done that when there is a lot of motion with the hands, that there can be an ease of speaking. And I've always spoken a lot with my hands, and it was funny to be like, oh, it's actually something that the body knows it needs to do to stay fluid, and particularly when we're all seated. In the beginning of COVID, I was part of a I was watching Peter Levine, who founded Somatic Experiencing, and one of my teachers, Dave Berger, talk about, okay, how are we going to do this on Zoom? How do we do somatic experiencing on Zoom? And Dave Berger was like encouraging all of us as practitioners and as humans, like when we're on screen, to have something to fidget with so that there is some movement that's always happening in the body. And I have these little fidgety things. And in this article, she talks about the ways in which culturally fidgeting is bad. It's like we should be able to be still all the time. And we know this when we sit with retreats, it's like, sometimes it's hard to be still, which is why we have the walking meditation, right? We sit and then we get up and we walk. And then we sit and we get up and we walk. We have Qigong, we have yoga practice to move the body. And the way that we've constructed our schools and our office spaces of sit still, stay. And the body's like, no. And the, you know, the kids with ADD, ADHD organize themselves through movement. And we've created a world where it's totally hard to do that. And we don't have to have ADHD or ADD to have that. That is a natural and inclination of the body. It wants to move. It's how we process things. And we know this, right? We're thinking about something, thinking, oh, we go outside. We get a different perspective. And this leaning into, this is sort of this outsourcing. How do we involve the world in the ways in which we think, in the ways in which we process, that not only allows us to have a sense of connection to the trees, to the rocks, to the water, to the animals around us, but also that our sense of belonging in the natural world, and how that can also then allow there to be, to stimulate the brain, to replenish that attention capacity. Couple things. Let's see. I know that was a lot of words. I'll say, I'll go talk a little bit more about this article and then we'll do an exercise. But she used the words extra neural. So I'm looking outside the brain, our resources, technology as an extra neural resource for our brains, like being able to put things in the phone, like phone numbers, so we don't have to remember it. We can put it somewhere else. The body, paying attention to what's happening in the body, tracking the body. There's studies done on the folks on Wall Street that make a lot of money in certain circumstances are very aware of their body's responses of like, don't buy this, sell it, don't do this, don't do that. And they've set up, they, scientists, have set up various experiments with people. Of the body knows things before the mind kicks in. And those of us who can cultivate that attention of like, ooh, the temperature on my skin just increased, or there's a clenching or a tightening somewhere. Those are cues. That's wisdom in the body. And the benefit that we can reap from when we allow ourselves to really pay attention to the body's sensations. The physical space, where are we? What can we draw from physically if we're out in nature? Another talk, this is a tangent, was talking about the inequities of where we live. I live somewhere that's very beautiful. Nature is very accessible to me. I live pretty close to Spirit Rock. That's not true for someone living elsewhere, where the access to nature is more difficult. Social interactions as another form of extending the brain. How can we cultivate our brain's capacity by engaging with others? And when is it through whatever technology is available, and when is it human contact, that physical body contact? And again, the strain on our resources, on our soul, I think, the toll of the social isolations and 6 feet apart and the fear of like, oh my God, don't get too close to me, is taking a toll on us in ways I don't think we yet understand, but we can feel it in the level of exhaustion or brain fog or fatigue or overwhelm. So, all right. So I ask you to close your eyes and just check in with the body's responding. It's like, oh my God, she's talking a lot. Or so where are you in your body? And just letting the attention rest again, a hand to the heart, hand to the belly in those hands. And then ask the question, where, from this place, if you imagine, where is your body most at ease? Is it at home? Is it in the woods, in the mountains, on the beach, in the field? It doesn't have to just be one place, but maybe to think more helpfully of sort of where are the different places, physical spaces, in which your body's like, I can relax here. And letting yourself conjure up that image of that place if you pick one. Again, it might be on the beach, by a riverbed, by a creek, in the woods, in your garden, on the porch. All of those I just mentioned are outside. So where is it for you? And what does the body feel like if you allow yourself to really drop in, opening up the sense doors? What's the smell of that place? What's the texture of the air around you smell? What are you sitting upon or standing on? Sand, mud, dirt, earth, grass, rocks. And letting yourself just take a few breaths here. Oh yeah, this is what this feels like. I don't know if you can hear my dog snoring behind me, but that's sort of accentuating the rest and relaxation. And so let go of that for a moment. And then where's the body? And just lightly touch into this. Where's the body more tense? I'm not asking us to go to the most tense, the traumatized place, but sort of where do you notice when the body starts to get constricted? And sort of scanning through the Rolodex of physical spaces, or it might just be with certain people, like, ooh, there's a tightening. And if it's okay to have a sort of playfulness of what's it like to toggle in between those places, the place where, like, ooh, there's a relaxation, the heart opens, the mind can be steady. For me, it's in the mountains. And where does the body constrict or get more tight? And it can be situational. It can be in a particular physical space. For me, it might be somewhere really crowded right now. Ooh, that doesn't feel good. And there's a constriction. And when we constrict, right, the blood doesn't flow as well. The air doesn't move through our body as well. The brain's not going to work as well. And this is just a single pointing to paying attention. And this introspection, the ability to pay attention to the felt sense in our own body as an extension of the mind. Citta, the Pali word, is the mind body. It's not separate. So I'm going to have a stop here. But before you open your eyes, just to check in, how's the body? What are you aware of in the body? A breath. You can feel the heartbeat, the belly, the shoulders. So, okay, I'm going to stop there. I know that was a lot of words. And would love to open it up to hear comments that you may have, or thoughts or questions.